Our next speaker is Sean Munro. Sean has been involved at various levels of the Australian Student Environment Network since 2010, and in 2011 he convened the local ANU Environment Collective, where he was involved in a successful campaign to get the ANU to de-invest its CSG shares. So I thought Sean's experiences were particularly interesting to hear about tonight as a local campaigner who has taken a stand on this issue. So, Sean.
Just before I start, I'll flag that I sort of have a respectful disagreement with Gavin's characterisation of the problem with the industry as a cultural one. I'm going to start with a story, like I said. It begins with a community of farmers. They live tough but simple lives, far removed from the hustle and bustle of city life. One day, a group of strange men showed up in their community. The farmers were shocked to find that these mysterious outsiders claimed to have ownership over the lands that they'd passed down through their communities for generations. "Don't just take our word for it," they said. They produced documents adorned with the signatures of city-based bureaucrats, and inscribed upon them was a clear message. The farmers' beloved land was no longer in their possession. It had become the property of these strange men. Now, the farmers weren't legal scholars, but it didn't make much sense to them that, you know, what had long been a community possession had somehow been appropriated by people that had no historical or cultural connection to their land. A mistake must have been made in the interpretation of the law. But attempts to bring the mix-up to the attention of parliamentarians, unfortunately, were unsuccessful, and it soon became clear that they were less concerned with protecting the farmers than collecting rent from the economic activities of these strange men. So, to their surprise, the farmers' decision to remain on the land irrespective of the law was met with the arrival of another group of strange men. This group, to their dismay, was armed with weapons. If the farmers refused to move, coercive force would be used and legal property rights that belong to this earlier group of men would be enforced. Now, you're probably wondering why I'm presenting this vague sort of caricature of the history of Australian rural communities and their experience with the coal seam gas industry in Australia. I'm not actually talking about Australia. The history that I just recounted was of the enclosures, a series of royal and parliamentary fiats issued in England between the 16th and 19th centuries. The Enclosure Acts were a sort of a subdivision of the Commons, which, as many of you probably know, was a system of collective land ownership that was governed by feudal custom. And it subdivided them into a tapestry of estates which were privately owned by rich landholders and could be traded as commodities. This movement of enclosures comprised a mass dispossession of peasant farmers, and they were one of the earliest expressions of contemporary forms of land management. They were also one of the earliest expressions of what we now call property rights, the much ordained and exalted basis of the capitalist economy. And, of course, are widely accepted as a precondition for modern economic production. These enclosures also happen to shed light on various aspects of the coal seam gas industry and the way it functions in Australia, and the opportunities that are available to any of us who want to shut it down. First of all, contrary to the prevailing media narrative, parallels between the enclosures and coal seam gas developments in this country demonstrate that the story of everyday people's expropriation by economic and political power is nothing new. This story is at least as old as capitalism. So let's just be clear about that from the outset. The enclosures make clear that the function of property rights, since their invention, has been unambiguously to serve the shared interest of elites. Not everyday people, and certainly not ecosystems. Nowhere has this been demonstrated more clearly than in the powerlessness of many landholders to stop the encroachment of coal seam gas developments on their properties. Secondly, the enclosures show how the state, that is, the government, the police force, and the courts, all the various sort of apparatuses of the state, represent, I believe, a false salvation from the ills of economic tyranny. The astounding complicity of the New South Wales and Queensland government in the ecologically and socially destructive CSG industry is inexplicable, I believe, in absence of a systematic connection between corporate and political power. Thirdly, the enclosures demonstrate how the coercive arm of the state, the police force, play a specific and crucial role in imposing the interests of capitalists over communities. The presence of riot police at the scenic rim blockade last year demonstrated the determination of the state to implement the existing economic order, irrespective of the wishes of the communities that were being destroyed by these developments. Finally, I think the enclosures demonstrate the way in which the law is structurally oriented towards the interests of CSG companies and all of the, the world of capitalists that sort of stand behind them, rather than the communities that they affect. By virtue of the government's control over resources under the ground, the so-called scales of justice are more often than not tipped against coal and coal seam gas communities. But even when they win, they lose. High Court decisions in favour of CSG-affected communities are changed by parliamentary decree, organisational resources are drained, and people's commitment to continue defending their communities against the expropriation of their ecosystems is exhausted by drawn-out court battles. In short, the channels by which governments and corporations encourage us to achieve environmental justice with respect to coal seam gas are some of the most deceptive obstacles to its realisation. Communities in the Northwest have learnt this firsthand. It is, after all, the utter failure of submission processes, meetings with ministers, and other time-consuming distractions which have left them with little option but to blockade their properties in order to protect themselves from the industry. Only with the lessons of history in mind will the anti-coal seam gas campaign be successful. I can only hope that its uncompromising and creative responses to the imposition of economic and political power up and down the East Australian coast will continue. They have, so far, been an inspiration to us all. As an exercise, on the way to the Newcastle blockade of the world's largest coal port on the weekend, some friends and I were doing a little sort of thought experiment in the ways or the various points at which during the process by which a coal mine, as an example, is approved, capital, the interests of these sort of multinational financial institutions and corporations that Ruth alluded to, like BP and, you know, the various other, you know, members of the global six, you know, elite oil producers, can basically pollute the pristine waters of political process. And there are heaps of them. I'm sure, you know, either one of the political representatives that are here tonight will tell you that governments can be corrupted at various stages along the road. So it is multinational capital, and these are strange men. I'll just say that the reference was to the scenic rim blockade, at which 20 peaceful protesters were rounded up by riot cops and 9 of them were arrested. So it is actually serious. And I think, like, if we go down the road that Carmel suggested is necessary, which I agree is necessary, it's going to get more serious, because history has shown that the interests of the state are aligned with business. And I see that as a sort of like an unbridgeable chasm in some sense. Or at least it can only be bridged by a mass movement of people who really want to see this industry stopped, and I think it has to be.